Hello everybody and welcome to the GMS Magazine channel. I am Paco Garcia, your host, and this is the RPG Interview Room, the show in which I am lucky enough to get together with people from the world of role-playing games and talk to them about their projects, their work, their life, their games. If you are watching the video rather than listening to the podcast, please know that this show is also in podcast format, so you can take it on the go. And if you're listening to the podcast, also please know that you can head on to our YouTube channel and watch this show in video so you can actually see people's faces and see who is behind your games. Please remember to subscribe either way, and if you can, please support us in our Patreon. You can find all the information in the show notes. I have been a long-term fan of Legendary Games because they produce some absolutely fantastic work, and they keep making things harder for themselves without losing any quality. And that is what's happening now with their Aegis Kickstarter campaign, because they have already funded a 600 pages adventure. I mean, this is mammoth. Six adventures by six authors all together to make a tome that you could probably kill a human being with. This is huge. But to make matters even better, they are releasing it for Pathfinder 1, Pathfinder 2, and 5th edition rules. So I needed to find out how on earth they are managing to do that. So I got together with them. I'm not going to keep rambling about it. I'm just going to let the show begin. Hope you enjoy it. Hello, guys. Welcome to the show. Jason, hi. Very nice to actually see you, because the last few times I've interviewed you, it's always been on audio. I don't think I've ever done a video interview with you, right?
I don't think so. I think we've always done the audio thing. So, hi, everybody.
We've leveled up. Hurrah. Thomas and Greg, welcome. I have never had the pleasure of talking to you, because I'm sure it's going to be. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And Tom.
Yeah, and Tom.
And Greg.
Especially you and Tom. Right. Okay, because I haven't had either of you on the show, I know that Jason can answer questions, but maybe he's forgotten how to do it. So we're going to do exactly the same thing that I always do with everybody who comes to the show. And I'm going to ask you five questions to make sure that A, you can answer them, and B, this will help profilers to know the kind of people you are.
Profiler.
Yeah, this is a very serious matter. Now right, okay, so question number one. Tea or coffee?
Neither. Coffee.
Okay, good. Good. The beach or the mountain?
Mountain.
Okay, good. Cars or motorbikes?
Cars. You're slow, Tom. Come on.
I know. I couldn't hear the first part of it. I wasn't sure what it was.
Just electronic, you know?
This is going to be a little bit harder.
Okay.
Not really. Fantasy or science fiction?
Fantasy.
That was easy. Okay, and now the last one, which is also, for you, it's going to be quite easy. Zombies or vampires?
Zombies.
Zombies.
Okay.
I figured you were a vampire guy, Tom.
Yeah,
oh my god.
He's like, you mean Twilight vampires? Because specifically that's what I like.
Oh, no, I'm fellow the ghosty vampires.
There you go.
Right, you're off. No, okay. Right, okay. Well, I have the three of you here, which is a first, because I have had up to two people in an interview today. But quite frankly, if Rachel asks anything of me, she gets anything of me. So we were going to have, how many of you were there going to be? Seven?
It was a bunch.
Wow. It was going to be like a party. But Skype would not allow it. So it's just the most illustrious ones who I'll save that one.
We got a little trophy right here to bush up.
Right. We're going to talk about your Kickstarter project, which it's gone to an absolutely fantastic start, because it's been for just a few days and you have already smashed some stretch goals.
We are $81 away from our ninth stretch goal.
Yeah, which, Jason, is not the first time you actually do this. You tend to do very well in these Kickstarters. Why do you think that is?
Learning horribly painful, bitter lessons from past Kickstarters. That helps a lot. But no, seriously, in learning what works and what doesn't, learning, you know, what audiences like and what they don't, offering things that are simple and to the point. We have run into some trouble in the past with Kickstarters that where the pledge levels were a little too complex, a little too confusing. The more straightforward you can go, the better. Having stretch goals that are clearly defined, having a project that is clearly defined. Some Kickstarters sort of run themselves into trouble with this incredible sprawl where they're trying to do so many possible things. And really, the Age of Empires Kickstarter is the example of that, of not going that way, of saying, look, this is what the project is. We're not offering plushies and t-shirts and giant vinyl mats and flying to your house. I mean, those things are all awesome and cool, but they're getting away from the point. This is just an awesome 600-page adventure saga for D&D 5e, for Pathfinder 1st Edition, for Pathfinder 2nd Edition. You want it? Awesome. Come and get it. And that's the project. Now, there's a place, I think at one time, Kickstarter was a little bit more of an experimental venture capital sort of a thing, where you'd say, I don't even know if people are going to want this, so let me see if I could build it up. And there still is a place for that kind of a project in Kickstarter, but I think that the market has shifted somewhat more to, here's a project that we are putting together that we are, you know, front loading in as much as we can, so that when we come to actually do the crowdfunding part, we're ready to just push it up and over and out and apply extra finishing gloss to it. We're not test marketing to see if we're even gonna start it. So I think there is room for both kinds of projects, but I think that you're setting yourself up for more success the more that you can get done ahead of time. And we've been working on this project. I've been on this project for about 2 years. Greg's been working on it in one way or another for 10.
I was going to say, you know, Greg's been at it for, I mean, Greg, what took you so long?
I had to get the world built.
Okay, that's about a weekend kind of project. Seriously, what took you so long? I mean, you've been developing this world for 10 years.
Yes.
That is an insane amount of time. Is it because you wanted to make it that detailed, because it was an on and off kind of project? Why did it take you a decade to get to where it is now?
That's a good question. So this project, I originally pitched to Paizo Publishing for Dungeon Magazine back in like 2007 as a Greyhawk adventure path concept. And then that was right about the time that Paizo lost their Dungeons and Dragons license and they couldn't use Greyhawk anymore. So it just got shelved and I didn't have anything I could do with it. But then I co-founded Frog God Games. And we started building the Lost Lands world setting out of all of the old Necromancer Games adventures, which we had bought Necromancer. Mm-hmm. And then out of all the new Frog God Games stuff that Tom has worked extensively with too. And as I was building this world and I could basically build it how I wanted, I was like, oh, wait, I can make this a world that will support that adventure path, Aegis of Empires. And, It required extensive rewrite because I had to take all the Greyhawk lore out. Mm-hmm. And there are still semblances in there where you can see, you know, if you're deep into Greyhawk lore, you go, oh, I can see how this might have been a Greyhawk thing. But it's the plots are all changed and everything like that. So I had to build this world as I was building the adventure path. And quite honestly, there was so much writing going on in building the Lost Lands and all the Frog God stuff, plus keeping up with Paizo stuff. I just didn't have time to dedicate to this. This was like way down my list of stuff to do. And we finally got there. So, yeah.
No, that's really good. Tom, what have you done? Because I know that Greg's built the world. What have you done for this project?
Yeah, what have you done?
I've done nothing. I don't know why I'm...
You showed up for the video.
Come on. Showed up for the video. They just said, want to be on the video? I'm like, okay. Actually, came to me when I was, when he was still Frog God, and I had this project, and it was a six-part adventure, and sent this, like, 40-page outline I remember looking at. And I'm like, holy crap, because I don't use outlines. I'm a terrible outline, and I'm terribly disorganized, but I can just, like, pull things together. So he says, do you want to write one of these adventures? And I'm like, okay. So he says, which one do you want to do? And I'm looking through it, and I'm like, wow, I see a lot of things that I did that were from one of the books that Greg pulled out. I'm like, well, that would make sense that I wrote that one, because it's a lot of my own stuff. So I ended up writing the fifth adventure in the path, which I believe, if I remember the outline correctly, was that it was kind of the climax, but not the climax, sort of, kind of.
It's a subclimax.
It's a subclimax. So had a lot of common themes in it that I remembered, and I had a great outline. I mean, Greg's outline was like, holy smokes, this is really like very, very detailed and very organized, but I still got to put a lot of my own little touches to it. So it involved a lot of puzzles and riddles and all that kind of stuff. So it's cool.
Tom had written some of the sort of terrain-focused books for Frog God, and what, Fields of Doom and Mountains. How many of those did you end up writing?
Five, but only four got published. One didn't.
Yeah, Icebound.
Yeah.
Got dropped at the last minute, it just didn't make the cut. I guess it was a good book too. I've seen the original stuff of it. It was really good. But yeah, okay. Tom brings up a great point, because the fifth adventure is this huge wilderness journey across this big old arid plain. And Tom had written a book called Fields of Blood, which covers plains, like not like PLAINS, not PLANES, like Great Plains types adventures. And he's like, maybe I should do this one. And I'm like, oh yeah, in hindsight, I did like pull half of the stuff out of the book you wrote to plot out this adventure. So yeah, it seemed like a good fit. That was really dumb of me to not realize to begin with.
Okay, and there have been several authors involved in this project. I mean, we're talking about six adventures, 100 pages each.
No. I wouldn't say they're 100 pages each. I'd say some are like, you know, 680 pages, and others are like 500 pages. No, I mean, Tom's adventure is the longest. I think it landed around 160, 170, something like that. So the adventures vary a bit in length. It's not quite a uniform, you know, regular thing, but that's the beauty of having your own publishing company. You can make whatever length you want. And as this thing is coming together, it will be released both as individual adventures and, of course, as a full compilation of all of the adventures and the appendices and the world material. There's a player's guide that goes along with it. So all of those things. You won't necessarily have a uniform price point for them, because you know what? Some of them be twice the length of the others, but all of them are packed full of some very cool stuff. But I think Paco was asking Greg about some of the other people that were working on the project. You want to introduce the Rogues Gallery involved there?
Yes. Yeah. So the first adventure, now my mind is blank. It's called The Book in the Old House, and it's by Alistair J. Rigg, who has written a ton of stuff for Paizo. He's written a lot of stuff for Jason at Legendary Games. the second adventure is called The Eben Soul, and it's by Dr. Jeffrey Swank, who has written quite a bit of stuff for Paizo. He's been an RPG Superstar finalist for Paizo. He wrote for Frog God some. Has he done any work for you before, Jason?
I don't think so. I think this is his first thing.
The third adventure, When Comes the Moon, is by Matthew Goodall, who lives in New Zealand. He's written a lot of stuff for Paizo. He's written a lot of stuff for Legendary Games.
He was also an RPG Superstar winner.
Oh, was he? Oh, I didn't
know. Was. I believe year three, year four, something like that.
Okay. Then the fourth adventure is by Stephen Helt of Four Horsemen Games, who has also done work for Legendary Games, has done work for Paizo, was also an RPG Superstar winner. He was one of the first ones, wasn't he?
No, he was about maybe five or six. He was after Madden.
Oh, okay. So I don't know anything about RPG Superstar winners, apparently. Then the fifth was Tom Knaus, who has written a lot for Frog God. Who else have you written for, Tom? I know we took up a lot of your time at Frog God.
Kobold sometimes. I do some stuff for them too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Plus, like you said, 5 full hardback books for Frog God Games just for the environmental series. And now Legendary Games with this one. And then for the 6th one, I got Anthony Pryor, who has done a lot of work for Paizo over the years. And gosh, I can't even name all the companies he's worked for, but he was working for Wizards of the Coast back in the day. Was he with TSR even before the buyout? I can't remember, but it would have been close to that because he was definitely on early 3rd edition stuff. Mm-hmm. So he's probably the most veteran of everybody involved.
So this is a question, I mean, either you, Greg, or Tom could answer this, because you've worked with this in your world, Greg, quite closely. But how did you guys manage to make sure that everybody who was writing the adventure kept some sort of consistency with the world and didn't go haywire with wacky ideas or bringing canon that wasn't meant to be there or actually bringing canon that you decided to include? How did you work that one out?
Sure. Well, Tom might have mentioned the 40-page outline that I gave them to work from, which I think did a lot of it. And to be quite honest, even though these guys are the headliners of the books, they're the authors, I wrote quite a bit in most of them as well, filling out for the very thing you're talking about. It would have been another 5 years if I was going to write all 6 of these adventures myself. So I turned to 6 really great writers who I would love to have involved in the product. And they turned over great products, but then to tie them in more firmly, because these books are ridiculously like footnoted to.
Yes, they are.
So even though this is Frog God Games game world, they allowed me to go ahead and finish this adventure path in it through Legendary. And so to do that, I just did citations throughout it. And I cite back to Necromancer Games books that are close to 20 years old, like page number citations, stuff like that, mm-hmm. where this concept came from, just further tying it all together, which is what I had been doing for the last 10 years. So I added a lot of that element to the awesome adventures that they wrote for me to kind of cement it in there.
Tom, what was it like for you? You know, once you get that 40 pages outline, which that would take me like a week to read because I'm a very slow reader. What is it like when you actually take a look at that and think, oh, okay.
It was pretty daunting. And I started reading through it and I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my
sorry,
God.
How am, I gonna
do this? How am I gonna do this? But each time I read it, I started actually stumping Greg a few times and going, wait, you put this here and then you said this here. Which one is it? And it was like, oh, you caught that one. Okay. So
I meant to do that.
It was good. It was really it was really so detailed and it had like everything just spelled out how it would work and how the entire storyline progressed that it was very easy to follow. And then it was very easy also to add your own touches to it. So I don't want to give any spoilers away for what I did with one, but there was one I thought was really hysterical. I don't know if people will pick up on it, but it was like this monster and the only thing it could get, it was like a space monster. And the only thing I could get was reception from certain television stations. And it incorporated that into its mindset. When you read the adventure, you'll understand what I'm talking about. It'll make more sense.
Okay. That's interesting.
I promise you it's not game world breaking what he's talking about.
No, not, absolutely not. It's not.
Jason, from your point of view, I mean, you guys have done some pretty hefty projects in the past, but have you actually done something with 6 writers and a huge world for 3 systems?
Actually, yes. And that would be the Legendary Planet Saga, which we've done for Pathfinder First Edition, for D&D 5e, and for Starfinder. The Pathfinder and the 5e versions are finished and actually are going live this week to to the general public. All the, you know, Kickstarter backers have finally got their books on the way. Everything is done. The 5e version is 748 pages. The Pathfinder version 732. And the Starfinder conversion is not quite done. The second to last adventure is in layout now, and the last adventure is in conversion at the moment. So, yeah, it's complicated. Our Alien Bestiary project also was for those same three systems, for Pathfinder 1, for Starfinder, and for 5e. It does make things more complicated. In a way, it's helpful in terms of logistical resources, things like maps and art and having one layout person be able to kind of cross over and do all the things. But it also contributes a great deal to sprawl, to project sprawl, because it just is so much more stuff to do and so many more people to wrangle. And that, again, is part of why for this project, we did so much more of our work running in the background this whole time. So for this project, all the Pathfinder 1 adventures are done. Almost all of the Pathfinder, I think I'm still waiting on the last two adventures, are just about done for Pathfinder 2. And I think adventures 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6 are done for 5e. I'm actually working on getting that one prepped for layout right now today. And I'm still waiting on the 5e one, Tom's adventure, which is that it's the longest adventure in the saga. And so it's taken a bit of work, and I just brought on a second person to work with the on the conversion team for that one. There's so much stuff to chew through. So it just, it makes things a lot more, it's a heavier burden on the project management side of it, just make sure everything keeps moving and everything keeps progressing, and the things that are fixed in one version, make sure they stay fixed across different versions. Because not each system has its own particular quirks, but there's also our flavor text things that I discovered, especially with Legendary Planet, it's very easy to miss little things in there. And for that matter, if there are just, you know, format quirks or italics or, you know, grammar or syntax or spelling or anything like that, if you fix it in one, making sure it gets fixed at all. So lots of little bits of things to make sure are correct all the way across. And that's where the magic happens.
Now, Tom, your adventure is the longest. Is it because they thought, oh, let's give this to the New Yorker, let's give it to him, or because you're unstoppable?
Oh, it's Greg's fault.
Oh, okay.
It is my fault.
No, I think I wrote, probably from what Greg told me last time I saw you at Gen Con, I think I probably wrote about a third of it from the expansion. I know you expanded one of these sections greatly. Yeah. So,
I mean, it is between a third and a half.
Yeah.
So, what Tom did was write me a fully formed, awesome adventure. And like you said, it's got all these riddles and puzzles and just all this classic role-playing D&D type stuff. Fantastic. And I looked at it and I was like, oh, but it doesn't do this thing I was hoping and this thing I was hoping. So basically I sat down and wrote an adventure around Tom's adventure. And mine, Tom's like, the heart of the adventure, the plot of the adventure with all the cool tricks and traps and riddles. And then mine's the world around the adventure that brings it in there. And Tom might have overwritten a little bit, and I overwrote maybe a little more.
And did.
Then I told Jason, I was like, is 19 maps going to be too many? And after Jason got out of the hospital, heart attack, it just turned out really long. But that's the thing, is I couldn't cut anything because it was so good.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, for you, what was the thing that when you read the outline, the thing that you thought, this is going to be the most challenging of this adventure?
Ooh, the part that Greg expanded greatly, because I had like a 40,000 word, I think it was actually 35,000 word limit. And I think I crept up to like 38, 37 and change. I'm like, oh, I'd really like to expand this. I'm going to have to really contract this section because there's no way I can get all of these plot points into place and expand upon this one area. So cutting is often much more difficult than expanding, because you can expand limitlessly, but cutting, you can only do so much until you lose absolutely, until you read it and it makes no sense anymore. And it's just, you know, so that was the trickiest part, was the main area where you, after this long, long journey, you get to, and now you're at like the climax or close to the climax of the adventure. And I had to contract it a lot. And that was the trickiest part, to contract it and still have it keep the feel that Greg intended and still advance the plot point so that you understand what's going on. You can progress. But what Greg did was expand that part and made it really what it really deserved to be, Jason, even though I see you cringing at that thought.
That's why it's 90,000 words now.
Ish.
Ish.
Yeah, I might have underestimated what the word count needed to be for what I was trying to accomplish with this adventure. And like I said, Tom showed excellent writing discipline, and then I just threw it all out the window and barfed as many words on it again to make it the beautiful, glorious adventure that it is now.
Mm.
How do you manage to keep 6 writers in check and make sure that they don't, you know, that the whole thing retains some sort of stylistic consistency? Because it feels like it's very much a art direction job, than anything else. How do you do that?
That happens in development a great deal. There's a lot of rewriting that occurs where you're basically just writing the same thing in a different way. Mm-hmm. You read what they're trying to say and then you just change the format to fit so it'll flow with the rest. With some of them, and this was not the case with Tom, some of them you get into lots of email arguments because these are, I didn't go hire 6 guys that didn't know what they were doing. These are guys with ideas and they're great ideas and they want to do this and that. And sometimes the idea is bigger than what the adventure they've signed on for will allow. So there's some of that happens. And then it's just all at the end of the day, making it fit together. And that's why you hire great writers, because great writers write great stuff. And if you've got to massage it a little bit, it works still.
Mm-hmm.
That fall apart.
You know, much to my shame, I still haven't asked, which I should have started with, on what the hell is the adventure all about?
That's a Greg question.
So it's partly it's a, so the Lost Lands, we got to start at the Lost Lands, the game world. So Necromancer Games started publishing all these adventures back in 2000, and they would just let the writers do what they wanted. They're like, hey, write us some classic old school adventures for the new edition of the rules. And they published, I don't know, like 75 adventures that way. And then Frog God came along and we started writing really big adventures like the Slumbering Tsar Saga, which was a 1,000-page adventure by itself that I wrote. Yeah. Now this is all starting to make sense now that I'm talking.
It's the trend.
And but also, like I said, we bought Necromancer Games. And so then I was trying to incorporate all these places that had been brought up. And there was all these mentions that keep occurring over and over again that had never been visited. So this, my goal of this path, not only to get to finally do those adventures I had been wanting to do all this time, but was to bring into focus places that people have been hearing about for years. Like literally some of those places you hear about in 2000 in the very early Necromancer Games adventures, but they've just never been visited in a product. And so the game world came out, which is, I think it's shipping now based on the emails I'm getting from the Kickstarter for World of the Lost Lands. And so this is a chance to highlight some of those places for the first time. This will be the first official adventure path that fully takes place in a Lost Lands context. And so it brings out some of these neat places that you've wanted to see. And also at its heart, it's a horror adventure anthology. And each adventure takes on horror in really kind of a different way. It's like if you were going to do an anthology and you decided to put in stories by H.P. Lovecraft and by Stephen King, and by Dean Koontz. And, you know, you just got all these very different style of horror writers. And so the fourth and the fifth ones are fairly similar because those link directly together. That's the sub-climax that Tom completed. But all of them just tackle these horror themes in very different ways. And so that was also what it was about. So it's a world building, it's a tour, it's a love letter, and it's six kind of gross horror adventures. All that.
And they all bind together. And the thing about the way that the world is presented, both in the adventures and in the player's guide, is that it is also self-contained. So even if you say, well, I don't have, you know, 80, you know, Necromancer games in my catalog, and I didn't buy, you know, Sword of Air or whatever else, you can put it in any campaign you want because it has all of the stuff in it. So you could put it in Greyhawk. You could put it in, you know, Galarian. You could put it in Forgotten Realms, wherever you want to put it. I had a question on the Paizo message board. Someone said, well, where would I put it in Galarian? And so I kind of thought, well, I'll kind of think about it in the world and what sort of geographically makes sense. You can pretty easily put this whole self-contained area, plop it down into any world you like. You may need to, you know, change some of the serial numbers to match whatever your local historical empires are to make it fit in that kind of way. But it's got everything you need in it. You can buy things like the World of the Lost Man's book, and we actually put a link to that in our Kickstarter page. And there's even a Grand Duchy of Rheim source book you could buy if you're really into that. So certainly you can dig as deep into the Lost Man specifically, because it's a rifled with literally hundreds of footnotes and lore that connect all of that stuff together. But it also has plenty of meat on the bone as it is that you can take it and put it anywhere you want without feeling like you have to go and get other stuff to make everything make sense. It's very internally consistent.
In terms of the support that the adventures are going to give both the GM and the players, what kind of locations and what kind of NPCs are people likely, or are they going to find in the six books?
Whew. Man, so the first adventure takes place basically entirely inside a haunted house. The second adventure is entirely situated in one city. It's several different locations, but it's got a very urban feel to it. Third, you're up in these desolate mountains, at a monastery that's operated by some very creepy monks. It's got a very Name of the Rose feel to it. The fourth and fifth adventures that are basically one giant adventure is this thousands of miles long overland treasure hunt that ends in a horrific way. And then the sixth adventure, the big finale, is entirely taking place within the vast ruins of a city that was an imperial capital 2,000 years earlier and was destroyed in a cataclysm. And it's sort of just been off, you know, people don't go there because it's bad, and it all takes place in there and sort of ties everything back together and into the history of the world, and all these little nuggets that have been dropped over the years and adventures sort of make sense. So it's kind of all over the place as far as the types of adventures, the locations, and the NPCs that you would meet. I mean, probably short of like an undersea adventure, it's got just about everything you could imagine.
And some of the NPCs are helpful, friendly. Some of them are two-fisted rat bastards, and, you know, it's all points in between.
And some of them can go either way, depending on what you do.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of those NPCs, how have you designed them to keep a kind of diversity and inclusion within them? What kind of NPCs are people going to be able to find within those adventures?
Gosh, I feel like all kinds. I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but like the final adventure involves a second adventuring party, more or less, of very high level NPCs. And they're, I mean, it's a humanocentric world. There are all the other races are present, but it's more human. So it's kind of typical RPG. So I think in that party, almost all of them are humans. Maybe there's a half elf or something. but like the leader of it is a very powerful woman who's a wizard. And so the gender representation, like I said, I haven't done a count for it, but it's not strictly a paternalistic, patriarchal type of thing. That there are powerful female characters, there are powerful male characters, there's bad female characters, there's bad male characters. Most are human, but certainly not exclusively. But it's just a very human feeling world, kind of.
Okay. Tom, what did you leave behind that you wanted to have in your adventure, but you didn't have the space to have? Because I bet that's happened.
Oh, wow. I think it was mostly going to be towards the end of the adventure, where the climax is, where you get to the ultimate destination, and you wanted to expand it, but I wasn't told to expand it, so I didn't expand it. But I also got the chance to build on, because one of the plot themes, the big plot theme in mine, comes from a book I wrote. So that was the part I would like to have expanded more and go into how it was done or why it was done and how this all evolved from something that started out very small and then morphed into something very, very big and potentially world-changing. So that would probably be the thing I would say, would be that aspect of this adventure.
Yeah, I totally lifted part of the plot directly out of an adventure that Tom had written for us. I mean, connected it, not just lifted it, like stole it, but like,
I made
what Tom had written into sort of a precursor to what this became.
Right.
And sort of made it look like that was the plan all along. It wasn't. I was totally borrowing Tom's stuff because it was really good.
Considering that you had to design the adventure for three different-ish systems, how hard was it to actually balance everything or to convert things from one system to the next to make sure that the experience is balanced and everybody's going to have the same level of experience? Because I hear a lot of horror stories about adventures that have been designed for an OSR system and they get converted to 5e and it doesn't work, or adventures that were designed originally for Pathfinder and then they go on to 5e and it doesn't work. How did you make sure that that wasn't going to be an issue for this tome?
Well, one of those things is experience, and that, you know, we've got over 100 5e products out. We've got, you know, many hundreds of Pathfinder products out. We've got a lot of people who have worked on a lot of things together. So some of that is the experience of people who know what they're doing. The second is the important design, you know, ethic, which is that when you're creating something that's going to work for more than one system, is to make sure that the important point is that it worked for the destination system. So there is not an absolute one-to-one, you know, fidelity from one, you know, version of product to another. You make things have to make sense where they land, not where they start. And so if you look through the book, you know, and you go to, you know, certain rooms, whatever, encounters may be rebalanced or retailored so that they fit with both the underlying math assumptions, the underlying sort of philosophical structural assumptions, and of course, with the actual numbers of the rules. Because those are all very different between Pathfinder 1 and Pathfinder 2 and 5e. And so you have to do a lot of work. And that comes with both the, you know, the development team. That comes also with me kind of back going back and cross-checking things. And it comes with just being able to do a fine look through all of these things to make sure it all makes sense for the system where it's going to land. Now, there is a certain degree to which adventures are adventures. But the way that they flow is different. The way that you, you know, heal and recover from damage is different in different systems. The way that sort of the assumptions of how much time things take is different in each system. So we've had experience not just with our own products. We also did the massive Kingmaker Adventure Path, you know, conversion project from both for Paizo, a legendary game did for going from Pathfinder 1 to Pathfinder 2 and cross-converting a lot of stuff for 5e as well. So it's a sort of thing that we have developed an expertise at, and we think that we do a really good job at, and we spend a lot of work and a lot of time on doing it. So no one's going to claim that everything will always be exactly note perfect, but to the extent that it's possible to develop and implement expertise, that's something we put a lot of time and effort and into, and then I think we did a really good job at. So the key things are mostly really work at it, really understand the systems you're coming from and you're going to, and make sure that for each version that it really fits with where you're going to be. And so there are some stuff Greg may be looking at the, you know, review copies and say, hey, wait, how come these watery monsters got cut? Or this kind of way. Well, because you may have, you know, six bestiaries worth of stuff in Pathfinder 1, but in 5e or in Pathfinder 2, we're going to condense some of these things together so they make sense in the destination system. And they flow in the way players for that game are going to say, okay. And GM for that game will say, okay, this works and this makes sense.
Yeah. Another feature of this adventure path that we haven't really talked about yet, I guess I thought it was going to be coming out during the course of the Kickstarter, which I guess is now. So this is an adventure path, but it's not a full campaign by itself. This is designed so that you incorporate this in with your own adventures that you want to run too. So it's not like a Paizo adventure path where you start your character out at first level, you play nothing but these adventures, and you end up at whatever level. This is, here are six adventures, and only Tom's and the one directly before Tom's actually link directly. Like, you go straight from one into the others. The other has space in between where you can add your own. And so that helps with the different systems because of experience variables and stuff like that. You may just roll straight from one into the other, or you may have an experience gap and you can plug in your own stuff. And part of the stretch goals of the Kickstarter campaign is providing free adventures, existing adventures that you know, Legendary has already done, that you can plug into those spots if you don't have your own that you want to do. And, you know, you want to make it no work at all, just go straight in. Well, here, stick these adventures with it. It'll include information on how to plug them directly in. But if you like to have more control over how your campaign goes, or you want to use some of those old Necromancer Games modules from 15 years ago, there's spots for you to do that too. So it will actually be a very different experience for every group that plays through this adventure path, because the GM gets to tailor it to exactly how he wants it to be, he or she wants it to be.
And those bonus adventures also are going to be available for all three systems. So if you back it for Pathfinder 1, you get the Pathfinder 1 versions. Back it for 5e, you get the 5e versions. Back for Pathfinder 2, you get the the Pathfinder 2 versions. Or you back from multiple systems, you get those, you know, bonus extra adventures for whichever systems you're supporting. So any way you slice it, you'll have, you know, stuff that you can't put in those level gaps. And then Greg's going to be writing up kind of a little guidebook to, hey, here's how you would link these adventures in to fit with the flow of each of Empires. And they all have a bit of a horror theme to them as well, to maintain that consistent sort of a flow.
Okay, let's talk business just before we finish. The campaign seems like it's going to hit, at the very, very least, it's going to go over the $50,000.
Yeah.
Quite easily. Probably 70. How big is this going to end up? Because after stretch goal, and I know that you're going to be adding an awful lot of new art, but you're also writing adventures. How large is this going to be?
Well, the bonus adventures are going to be released as PDFs. They will not be added into the core book itself because they're not part of the Age of Empires story. They are optional, you know, extra material that you can do. They're bonus material. What's going into the final book is what's going into the final book. You know, which sounds a little circular, but we're not trying to make this some giant bloated project that's going to take us a year to fill in all this extra stuff. No, the book is the book. We've got a lot of the stuff done in layout now, pending some sort of final proofreading and some review, some spot checks on some of the maps and things. So we've got some bits and pieces to finish there, but we've got stuff in layout that's already done, sort of sitting on the shelf and, you know, basically ready to go once we complete that final pass. So in terms of how high will it go, that's really an open question. And one thing with this campaign, this is the first big, you know, third-party, you know, Kickstarter kind of project for Pathfinder's second edition. And so we're curious to see what the response, you know, will be to that. And so far, it's been good. Pathfinder 1 has actually been the most popular of the systems so far with backers, and then 5e in between. So that was sort of an unknown unknown. And also, of course, the current pandemic situation, there's really no way to know for sure what the response will be like in terms of people's disposable income. On the one hand, you could say, hey, role-playing games are a fantastic, you know, dollar value for the amount of play and enjoyment you get out of it. And being able to get something, you know, for $50 that may give you a year's worth of entertainment or 2 years worth of entertainment, that's a pretty good deal. Yes. On the other, people will say, well, shoot, I'm not sure where my next paycheck's coming from. So I don't know if I could pledge to it at all. So that's another unknown that we just kind of see how it all plays out. We are hopeful and excited. We, you know, had a great start. We're sort of in the flattish middle that pretty much all Kickstarters go through. And like I said, this should easily clear 50,000, probably somewhere, you know, closer to 70,000. It may hit 100,000. I don't know. We are,
that'd be nice.
Yeah, I'd love it. It all depends on how well we continue to spread the word and how well we're starting up a new ad campaign cycle starting this week. And then also for people who maybe missed the Kickstarter during, but who want to join on afterwards on like BackerKit after the fact, that's also always an option too. People are more mindful about their finances because they just don't really quite know for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the business conundrum. But at the same time, we figured, you know what? We've been working on building this thing up. We've invested in the writing, we've invested in the art, invested in the maps, invested in a lot of stuff. We think we've got a great product. Let's put it up there and see what people think. And so far, the response has been very good. So,
And the difficult question that I have to ask is, how are we poor Europeans going to get our hands on this? Because shipping costs can be, a killer, quite literally.
They can be, and that's a place where I can answer that in a couple of ways. First, of course, is obviously you can buy the PDF, and that's easy to do. As far as the print book, there are a couple of ways to do it. And it depends on what the final backer numbers are as to whether we would want to do a full offset print run or not. And even if we do any of these versions as an offset print run, you know, that creates its own set of issues. What we have traditionally, for European backers, we have onboarded an amount of our books to Amazon and then use Amazon's shipping system, which is a fair bit cheaper than really any other method. So if we do go that direction, we would use them as our sort of, you know, fulfillment to international backers. But we also will be creating, you know, print-on-demand versions, which we have shipping venues. I think there's one in the UK and maybe one in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will be able to ship directly from those. So if you say, I don't want to pay, you know, $50 or $60 or whatever the insane shipping might end up being for the offset book, you could still get the print book at a cheaper shipping rate. We are all of the shipping we are charging after the project. There's no shit. You don't add on for shipping during the Kickstarter. We'll be sending that out and billing that through BackerKit. So if you decide, you know what, I'd rather pay, I think Spain shipping for book this size for instance would be probably around $20 for a print-on-demand version of the book. So mm-hmm. If you say, I'd rather pay $20, get the print-on-demand, but then we could do it that way and send you a book from, you know, an in-Europe shipper as is. And so the tipping point just comes of us figuring out how many books are we going to need of each of the versions. And, you know, it's usually around 300-ish or so books. Once you get much past there, then it financially makes a lot more sense to buy a full print run of 1,000 of them rather than just buying them one at a time, just based on the economics of it. But so those would be some of our options. Is that we do fulfill through Amazon, and that helps a lot with shipping of a traditional offset book. But we also will offer print-on-demand options for, and the print-on-demand books have gotten so much better over the last couple of years that we're much happier offering that as an option. Once upon a time, they were not great, but now they really have come up a lot, and they're offering a very solid product. So that'll be an option that each backer can make for themselves as to whether they would, you know, how they want to do it.
Good. All right. Okay. To wrap it up, Tom.
Yes.
Give me your completely unbiased reason why people should buy this.
You should buy this because this builds upon one of the best, if not the best, campaign setting ever created. The Lost Lands is amazing. I worked on the book, The World of the Lost Lands. So I have that feel, and I have the feel from writing this adventure. And if you're looking for a world that's really rich and deep and feels to me organic, because some of them don't. Some of them feel just very cookie cutter and thrown together because, well, we need this area here and we need this type of style here and we need this type of place there. And this doesn't have that feel. This feels like it developed naturally. I mean, Greg's backstory for the Lost Lands is incredibly detailed and it makes a lot of sense when you read it. It flows very naturally. And anything that derives from that will derive really well and it'll be enjoyable to play because you can go, as he said, down a lot of rabbit holes. You know what? This adventure was really cool. I really like this area. Let me go look a little deeper into it. Oh, wow, there's another product I can use, or there's another product, or there's something similar I can do for that. So it's really, to me, it feels like a launching point into the Lost Lands, if that's where you want to go.
Greg, how do you feel about that?
Well, thank you, Tom. Get a little misty here. I agree with what he's saying. I think it's funny that he mentioned the world history, the backstory of it, because so much of that stuff has been under wraps literally for like 10 years. We would just give little peeks to it until now. I guess it's going to be in the World of the Lost Lands book. So yeah, you get to see the organic development of it. As for why I think you should get it, in addition to the reasons that Tom says, it's just some really cool adventures. I'm an old school gamer. I started like 79. So, you know, I was playing all the old Gary Gygax modules and the Dave Arneson stuff and all that. And there's just a feel about it. And there's nothing wrong with new adventures. In fact, production values and the writing honestly has improved a lot in over the decades. But the goal was to really kind of capture that and also invest it with some horror themes, which I know horror themes have been done before very well. So it's not like we're reinventing the wheel, but I feel like we made use of these tools that have developed over the last 40 years really well. And just, it's just going to be fun to play. I've run a few of them at cons just as sort of introductory games to it. Man, I have so much fun running those games at cons because the adventures are just so cool.
Right. Okay. To wrap it up now, I usually have three questions for my guests, but we're going on to 50 minutes now. So I'm going to ask you a question each. Mm-hmm. And who wants to be number one? Jason. Okay, fine.
I'm number one.
Thank you for volunteering. Right, okay. What is the best advice that no one has ever given you?
Oh, man. Thank God you're number one.
Always be awesome all the time. I mean, it sounds simple, but, you know, it's very easy to sort of half-ass your way through a lot of things. But, you know, whatever you're going to do there, that's going to be your name on it. So why not be awesome?
Okay. You know? No. That's a very good one. Great. You can arm wrestle this one between the two of you. Who wants to be number two? Greg, okay, good.
Second
good.
Question easier or harder than the first question?
They are just as, all of them just as weird. Okay, Greg's number two. Good. Okay, number two. What's the best mistake that you would like to make again?
Oh, gosh. And that I would like to make again.
Yeah.
That is super hard. The best mistake that I would like to make again. Let's do Tom's question and I'll think about this. I'm not as quick on my feet as Jason is coming up with an awesome answer. I'm trying to come up with any answer.
Okay. So, Tom, imagine you have a time machine.
Uh-huh.
And obviously, you're going to back in time because the future hasn't been made yet. So you go back in time and you meet your 10-year-old self and you tell your 10-year-old self, do not do this. What is this?
Do not do this. Do not go to college and get an English degree.
Fair point.
Okay, that makes me wonder, why not?
Why?
What's wrong with an English degree? Not that I have one.
I have an English degree. I do. I live comfortably. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
My brother has a finance degree.
Oh, he lives comfortably.
He has a theater in his house. He has a gym in his house. His house is 5 times the size of mine. So I might want to follow down his career path more so than mine.
Okay. So you can speak and your brother can make money.
Yes, I can speak and write. He makes the money.
Okay, Greg, let's go back to you.
All right, back to me. I guess, so the biggest mistake that I would like to make again is when I was a kid, I got heavily involved in kind of a nerdy hobby with rolling dice and sitting at a table with a bunch of other dudes. And I guess it's sort of mainstream now, but man, when I was growing up in the 80s, it was not. You went to hide in the basement to play you some D&D. Mm-hmm. And I loved it so much that I kept doing it. And I'm sure it definitely hurt me socially over the years. Dating wise, you know, whatever. But yeah, I mean, I would make that mistake again because it's been wonderful. I mean, here we are. I'm having a Skype conversation with 3 guys all over the world at the same time. And it's mm-hmm. I'm just having a blast. So I think that would be it.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's a fantastic answer. Humans, thank you very, very much for being with me today. And congratulations on the campaign, on the adventure.
Thanks,
I think they're worth and overdue. And I very much look forward to the next 1,000 pages that I am absolutely sure that you will be writing in the next 20 minutes or so.
They're coming soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Paco. Have a great one, man.
Thank you.
This is brilliant. To be honest, just the fact, you know, as a publisher, just the fact that they managed to put together so many people, manage that and get out something amazing is incredible. The fact that no one's gone crazy in the process, that is just absolutely unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the final product is like. Please do take a look at the Kickstarter. You can find a link down there in the show notes. And let me know what you think. Let me know if you've played any of their previous adventures and games. And I would absolutely love to hear what you have to say. Once more, please do remember to subscribe and support us in our Patreon if you possibly can. But until the next time, I will be talking to you very, very soon. Take care.